The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to seven continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the last Tuesday evening Space Show in April 2019. It's April 30th. Welcome to the program tonight. I'm your host, David Livingston. Thank you all very much for tuning in. We're a little bit off topic, but maybe not that far off topic tonight, because we're going to talk about what people like to refer to as flying cars, although we're going to be a little bit more specific as the program goes forward. Tonight will be the planned 60-minute format, but if we go over, we go over, which is usually the story of Space Show program. But do pay attention to the time, and if you do want to get a call into our guest or an email, make sure you do it while we're still broadcasting the show and not 5 or 10 minutes after the show's off the air. So it is planned for 60 minutes, and we'll see how that works. And then we have a regular program for Friday and another regular program for Sunday. There is no Hotel Mars this week because I, being at the ripe old geezer age of about to turn 73, am required to show up for the DMV test. And they scheduled it right during the middle of when I do Hotel Mars. So there's no Hotel Mars program this week, although I might feel like wanting to be on Hotel Mars after getting through with the DMV. But we're happy to have this program. Let me get started and tell you a little bit about the Space Show and then our program tonight. So toll-free for those of you who want to call us, 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screeners. Be patient. Let it ring, and I'll bring you up on the air as quickly as possible. You can also use email to reach us, drspace@thespaceshow.com, and then you can also post on our blog. And if you're not familiar with doing that, it is on our website all the way to the far right, upcoming show menu. This is the first show listed. Open it up. Comments are down at the bottom, and as soon as you hit the send button, I'll get a copy of what it is you want to say, and then I can integrate it into our discussion tonight. But remember, the telephone is our preferred way of communicating with our guests, and that number, once again, is 1-866-687-7223. If you go to our website, thespaceshow.com, remember our newsletter is there for the week. You'll see it over on the upper right side. And when you open it up, not only do you see the events for this week, you'll see all of the programs we're adding. And we're now showing dates through September of 2019, although we have a few June and a few July dates left, and then we're opening up again big time. Suggestions for guests are always, always welcome. So remember that everything we do is archived. You can listen right off of our website or easily download the program. There's a short email newsletter that goes out Monday morning, 6 a.m. California time. If you would like to receive it, send me your email address. Upper left menu tells you how to listen to archive programs, and you'll see it there. Listen to the Space Show and how to listen to podcasts, including Alexa. And if you have any questions, please don't hesitate to email me. Our players are embedded there, and if you have any problems using them or anything like that, do get a hold of me and let me know, and I'll be happy to troubleshoot as best as I can. There is a Space Show store. If you're interested in things with the Space Shuttle logo on it. The easiest way to access it is over on the right side, and on any of the website pages, you'll see Pepper, my Siberian Husky, listening to the Space Show. Just click on Pepper's picture, and it'll take you to our Cafe Press store, where you can see all of the different logo items that we have there. And we thank you for that support. Remember, we are trademarked and copyrighted, and you're free to download programs, although just giving people the URL is a lot faster and easier. But you are free to do that. There's a couple of rules. Don't do anything commercial. Don't do any edits or copies. Don't put anything up on YouTube or other websites, including your own, and written transcripts are not permitted, even if they're for your own use. If you do want to have a specific use for something said on a Space Shuttle program, please email me, and let's see if we can work it out. I'm a pretty flexible guy. So just always the best thing to do is to ask before you do it. Podcasting is through gigadial.net, and hopefully you don't have any problems, but if you do or any questions, don't hesitate to get a hold of me again, drspace@thespaceshow.com. The most important part of our homepage to me is the fact that we ask you to support the Space Show. Remember, we're listener supported. We are a nonprofit 501c3. Our parent is one, O-N-E, GiantLeapFoundation.org, and your contributions enable us to do the programming and have great programs like what you're going to hear tonight. So on our website, you'll see the PayPal button over on the right. That tells you how to support us via PayPal, as well as sending in a check by mail for those of you who don't want to do it electronically. There is a big Amazon button in the middle of the page. And we have two Amazon nonprofit programs that you can choose from. And you can just buy your goods through Amazon like you normally do, unless you use their Smile program and then you use their cloned Smile site. But all of that is explained there. And when you do that, Amazon gives a purchase of the, gives a percentage of your purchase price to the Space Show. So we appreciate those of you that do buy products from Amazon and name us as your nonprofit. And it is beneficial, and we thank you, and we thank Amazon for that support and for those programs. In addition to the individual gifts I've just mentioned, there are sponsorships for the Space Show. So here, the sponsors get a banner ad running across the homepage, and they can change that banner ad as often as they like. And on 90-minute or longer shows, I read a short message from each sponsor, first segment, then second segment of the show. On the shorter programs like tonight, I just acknowledge our great sponsors, because honestly, without our sponsorships, we would not be doing the Space Show either. And we do have some really great sponsors: Northrop Grumman, the Space Foundation, Moonwards, AIAA, the Space Development Network for Space Settlement, Celestis, the National Space Society, and the Integrated Space Plan. So look at their banner ads, click on them, see what's underneath the banner ad, what's behind the curtain, so to speak. And if you want to reach anyone at these organizations, you can do so through me or directly to the organization, but I have the contact people that help with the Space Show, so I'm happy to put you in touch with them. And we are deeply appreciative of our sponsorships and sponsors. If you're interested, email me and I'll give you the detail. And if you're interested in becoming an advisory board member for the Space Show, email me and I'll tell you how to find out about that and see if you would like to join us. And we appreciate your interest in that as well. Excuse me. So our program tonight features a first-time guest to the Space Show. I hope I'm getting his name correctly. I know I got the first name correctly. That's Bruno. So I have... And you can correct me, I'm not modest here. Mom Brinney, did I get it right?
You got it.
Wow. And he is the founder and lead designer of MetroHop. And you can go to their website. It's metrohop.aero, A-E-R-O. And this is an all-electric, short takeoff and landing airplane. It takes off and lands virtually silently, flies at about 250 miles an hour, and is designed to move cargo and people within a 100-mile radius of San Francisco. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. Bruno founded MetroHop in 2018 after working on his design for several years. He's no stranger to electric flight and aviation innovation. When he was at MIT, he helped build the Chrysalis human-powered airplane. After graduating from MIT with a degree in mechanical engineering, he went on to found AVEC Scientific Design, a medical equipment manufacturing company. He has been a board member of CAFE Foundation since 2010, and that promotes efficient aircraft designs. In 2011, as part of that foundation, Bruno served as the event manager for the NASA Green Flight Challenge sponsored by Google. The purse was $1.65 million, the largest aviation prize in history. We are honored to have Bruno join us. Bruno, welcome to the Space Show. How are you?
Hi, Dr. David. Well, it's really an honor. I'm a big fan, so it's really an honor to be here tonight, and I appreciate it.
So I've seen the video several times, and
yeah.
Listeners, if you haven't seen it, again, I urge you to go to their website and see the video. But tell us, for listeners who haven't been to your website yet, what is MetroHop?
So it's our idea of using a fixed-wing airplane for urban air mobility, so for carrying passengers and cargo in metropolitan areas. So in this case, we're specifically looking at the San Francisco Bay Area, and we're going as far as Sacramento to the east and, you know, as far down as Monterey. And that's the area that we're looking at right now in the first calculations. We started this project way back after the NASA Green Flight Challenge. And we just really started it as an economic study to see if flying taxis was a viable idea. And with that, we realized that we needed something that to be economically viable had to be the key ingredient was high utilization. And so that means a fast plane. A plane that can take off and land quickly to clear the airspace, and then a plane that is easy to get in and out of. In other words, the turnaround time has to be quick also. And so by doing all these things, we're able to do something that's actually pretty viable. We're looking at fares of $39.
Where does it take off from? Any place? Somebody's backyard? Do you have to have an airport?
No, that's the thing. This is a little different than a lot of the flying car ideas out there. We actually need a piece of infrastructure. And in this case, you know, the main markets are in very large urban areas, like in the center of San Francisco, the center of Fremont, or the center of the main urban areas around the Bay Area. And so for that, we have to be up on top of buildings. It's really the only place we can do that. And we need a space that's about 100 meters by 100 meters, so 300 feet by 300 feet. And in that space, we can have two runways, and we need about 200 feet for the plane to take off and land in. And we use two runways, and they can point in any direction. So we basically take off and land always directly into the wind, and that's a critical ingredient there.
So I'm a single pilot, land and sea, and I would think that you'd have some pretty high winds on top of a high-rise building.
We do. It's actually, unless it gets over like 50, 60 miles an hour, it's actually fine. The building has to be designed right, and the airstrip has to be designed right so that we don't get too much turbulence or big pockets of air like coming up and destroying the airflow around the airstrip. But we can monitor because it's just one area we're landing on, or it's, well, how did I say this? We're not landing just anywhere. So these are fixed places that we land on, and so we can monitor very carefully the flow there and anticipate what the plane is going to see before it gets there.
Is there a building today? I mean, I know the listeners probably aren't familiar with San Francisco, but you and I are. Is there a building today in San Francisco that you can identify that would be ideal for takeoff and landing?
Well, so this is a little bit a ways off, because before we can get there, a lot of the things that we need to happen, the rules and regulations for, don't even exist at this point.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine. Okay.
So it's a little bit ways off, but the area around the Embarcadero Center, for example, would be a very nice area, and we wouldn't necessarily land on one of the existing buildings. We'd possibly have a tower that's between the Embarcadero buildings serving all those buildings. You have to remember that we're adding a piece of infrastructure, and then we're adding 12 elevators to be able to go up and down to the skyport. We call it a skyport, the airport. And so we need an additional 12 elevators, and that's really difficult to add to an existing building. And you can't use the buildings that are already existing elevators, because you're going to overwhelm the capacity of those. So we have to have our own elevators. So we have to either add to a building or start with new construction. And we're seeing a lot of new construction around the Bay Area anyway. And we see this as in the future, as new buildings go up, the idea is that they incorporate a skyport on top, or the ability to have a skyport on top.
Okay, so San Francisco, again, listeners, pardon me, he wants to do it in San Francisco, and I'm living adjacent to it, and Bruno is also living kind of adjacent to it, similar area where I'm living. You can't even fly a medevac chopper in San Francisco.
That's correct.
So how the hell are you going to fly?
Okay, so one of the advantages of our plane is that we can take off and land virtually silently. I mean, no more noise than an electric car. And the reason we're able to do that is because we actually use the landing gear, at least for takeoff, we use a Formula One slick as one of the wheels to actually drive the plane to takeoff speed. In 200 feet, you could not, a propeller could not accelerate a plane to takeoff speed. So we actually use a wheel that's motorized. It's electric motorized, and then we can drive up to takeoff speed to take off.
So you used racing car acceleration to get you off.
Right. It's actually not that vigorous of an acceleration. We go from about 20 miles an hour to the takeoff speed is somewhere around 60 miles an hour, and we do that in 4.5 seconds. So it's pretty good acceleration, but it's nothing to get too excited about.
And if you don't make it and you fall down to the street, what's your game plan for preventing that kind of accident?
Well, first we have a plane that's got very large wings. It's an excellent glider to start off with.
Uh-huh.
The plane has got more sensors than it is airplane. It's really a flying robot. It is not piloted. The plane does not have a pilot on board.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Are you kidding me?
No. So it is an autonomous plane. However, we do have a mission control where we do have expert pilots, and we have co-pilots and flight engineers and medical team and so on. And the reason for that is in a bad situation, the problem with computers is even the best AI and deep learning machines, and we need those, but they don't have basic common sense, they don't have empathy, and they really command no authority over most people. And in a bad situation, you kind of need those things. You kind of need something that has, like a person that has common sense, empathy, and some authority.
So it's basically a drone.
It is, and the economics do not work with a pilot on board. And it doesn't work from a safety point of view, and it doesn't work from a practical point of view. So we really do need to have that was one of our first things we realized was that. Well, first we realized that the plane has to be safe, and it has to be quiet. If it's going to fly in and over cities, it's going to have to be very quiet. And it has to be very, very affordable. And to do that, we really had to take the pilot out of the plane. And so that's how we got there. What I was going to say about the landing gear is that for landing, that is also one of the function of this special landing gear we have. So the plane is really a very conventional plane. The wings have more flaps and slats than you would normally see on a small plane, but it's basically that basic technology that you would see on a jet with multiple flaps and forward slat.
And it's propeller, right?
It is propeller-driven, and it has two very large propellers that turn relatively slowly, so they really don't make much noise at all. And so for takeoff, we do not use the propellers to accelerate. Again, the propellers are on, but we don't have to rev them up and make a lot of noise. And then when we land, we actually, we don't use the propellers to slow down. We actually have brakes on the landing gear that actually slows the plane down.
So takeoff and landing, your propellers are basically feathered.
In takeoff, the propellers are on, but they're not. In a normal plane, you over-rev the propellers to try to get as much bite, as much traction as you can. And in our case, we don't need to do that because the acceleration is from the wheel. And then in landing, we basically land with the propellers off.
You've already got a phone call. You ready for this?
Sure.
Hang on. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Are you ready to fly over San Francisco?
Yes, yes.
Listen, it's probably better than walking around San Francisco, given there's probably no hypodermic needles and poop up in the air yet. So it's probably a more sanitary way to visit the city.
I got to go to San Francisco once. I enjoyed it because my daughter and I ran a part of the Golden Gate Bridge, and we visited a couple of spacecraft facilities. It was a wonderful time. It was rather cool, and it was. I liked the town.
It was a long time ago, Marshall.
Yes, it was.
Didn't your daughter won a contest, right?
Yes.
Yeah,
well, it was on the space show.
Yeah, I remember, with L'Oreal, right? She won a L'Oreal contest. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And she remembers that trip very well, and she talks about it to her kids.
Perfectly. Good. Maybe she'll get them interested in being rocket scientists or engineers. What's your question or comment for Bruno?
Yes. I'm actually working on an airplane called the Titan Tornado SS, which can land in about 250 feet.
Okay.
And the specifications you're talking about, I think, we are talking about a light sport aircraft, which is a category of aircraft.
Right.
But I also remember back many years ago when the V-22 was being developed, and they talked about the V, I think it was called the 609, which was a two-seater V-22 that was supposed to be able to land in very small places, had vertical landing capacity. But the problem 10 years ago was the computing power to, make everything work smoothly without surprises.
Right.
And you were talking about the artificial intelligence and the remote systems, and I kind of go, this sounds like a review of the old tilt rotor takeoff and landing systems.
Okay.
Is that in there?
No, not at all, actually. We don't tilt the rotors. We don't tilt the wing. We don't tilt anything. This is a regular fixed wing. It's not a light sport airplane. It's quite a bit heavier than a light sport, so that's a little bit different there. But it's... it's reminiscent of a Canada Air or of even some of the military transports. I mean, but much smaller. I mean, it's a 5,000-pound airplane. It's not a 50,000-pound airplane.
Mm-hmm.
It's got the blown wings, basically, and it has, a lot of the triple flaps and front slats. It has wings that really deploy out, and it's got a cruise speed of about 220 knots or 250 miles an hour, so it's a lot faster than a lot of the light sports, and like I said, it's quite a bit heavier also. We carry a pretty good size load of batteries on board, as you can imagine.
What can it carry for cargo, suitcases, and passengers?
Well, so in a passenger version, it'll carry two... 365 kilograms, so that comes out to about 800 pounds or so for passengers and cargo. So that's actually a pretty good size. But again, we want to be able to carry two big athletes, two big people on board without a problem with their luggage.
So it's a two-person capable vehicle.
You're right. And as a cargo plane, it holds 5 cubic meters or about 900 pounds, or actually 950 pounds of parcels, of packages.
Mm-hmm. I would like to, I presume this is going to be commuters, so I assume there's a fairly short range. What, 100 miles?
Correct. And actually, we see it more as kind of a business tool. It's $39 for a flight, for a one-way flight. That's not bad, but it's maybe a little steep for a lot of commuters. It's good for if you're doing any kind of business. Instead of sitting in traffic and being paid to be in gridlock,
it's better than a taxi
to get there already.
Is there a cockpit at all? Like if the thing starts to go haywire and somebody on board knows how to fly, is there something they can jump in and take control of it?
No, there isn't in the cockpit. There is on the ground, and somebody on the ground can take control.
So there's no stick, there's no pedals, there's nothing.
There's a monitor. There's a monitor where you can you can view your crew on the ground.
You can watch it go to hell. That's what you do with the monitor, right?
But as far as no, there's no controls on board. There's a lot of safety and security issues with that, and so we really want to count on expert pilots to be flying this if it has to be taken over.
Is it all weather aircraft?
It is. We're starting in the San Francisco Bay Area because the weather is actually to our favor, but the same kind of technologies that are used for de-icing and for all weather conditions can be applied to this the same. It's really, as far as the plane itself is concerned, it's just very, very conventional. There's nothing very exotic about it. The landing gear is the only thing that's a little bit different than normal landing gear, because our landing gear is active. So the issue is when you come to land, you not only have to land in, short in 200 feet, but you have to hit your landing marks within plus or minus 15 feet, and you can't do it like on an aircraft carrier where you kind of just slam into the landing marks. We have to do it very gently.
That brings up the, I think it was called the Cat 3 automated landing systems, and
okay.
I presume you're using differential GPS to basically hit that mark.
We're doing that. We actually also we have sensors in the landing gear legs themselves, and so what happens is when we're flying over the landing marks, we can be off plus or minus about 20 inches. And the landing gear takes care of the difference, basically. So right when we're over the landing marks, the landing gear goes for the ground and closes that distance between the airplane and the ground. So we hit landing marks every time.
That's interesting. Extendable landing gear. I love it.
Exactly.
Are the gear retractable?
The gear is retractable, yeah. If you see it, if you look on the video, it's actually a very simple system, and it's controlled by a ball lead screw with a brake on it, and so we're able to drive it very fast, and we're able also to stop it, or we're able to dissipate when the plane comes down on the landing gear. So you imagine this landing gear sticks down and reaches for the ground, and then the plane has to come down on that, and so we back drive the lead screw to actually lower the plane, and we dissipate that energy through disc brakes. So it's a very simple system. And it's, very, very reliable and very effective. And it looks, people who look at this, especially if you're a pilot, you say, wow, this is a lot of landing gear mechanism that you're adding to this plane. And it is, but we're fine. We can afford to have it on there. And it's actually not as heavy as it might seem, or it's not as encumbering as it might seem. And it really helps us for other things on the ground, to drive the aircraft quickly to the terminal to get people on and off. And that's really what's driving us, is how quickly we can turn around, how quickly we can move to because that's the key to success and to keeping the fares really low.
What altitude does it fly at?
I'm sorry, say that again.
What altitude does it fly at?
Oh, so we're going to try to fly basically as low as we can, as far as, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 feet. There's really no reason for us to go any higher, and if we can fly in that range, that would be perfect for us.
Mm-hmm. I got a question about the control system.
Yes.
I'm rather closely familiar with the Neely Aero, which is one of the drones that they're using to fly back and forth across the Mexican-United States border,
okay.
You know, Border Patrol and so on. And, of course, you know, there's Global Hawk and several other long-distance drones.
Right.
Are you using the technology from them directly, or are you making your own?
Well, at this point, the first rendition of this airplane is as a cargo plane, and as a cargo plane, it's a piloted plane. And we've actually, like, spent quite a bit of time discussing the idea of, you know, are we going to have fly-by-wire? Because eventually, of course, this is going to be fly-by-wire. But right now, to start, even the first version, the first commercial version, will not be fly-by-wire. It's a very, very complicated process, and it's actually very difficult to certificate software for these kind of systems.
Mm-hmm.
So at this point, there isn't a package that we can buy to do this, and the project for doing the fly-by-wire on this aircraft is as much work and effort as doing the whole aircraft, if not more.
Yes, so airplane design is well understood. Electronics to drive airplanes, that's a whole new category.
Exactly, it really is. And they've done a lot of progress with cars, for example, from the first DARPA challenge to what we can see now, you know, for example, what
mm-hmm.
Cruise is doing. So there's some amazing things out there that have happened. And, you know, this will come along too with controls for aircraft. But it's not there yet, and it's something that is extremely, extremely expensive at this point and intensive to perfect. So
well,
at this point, we can do for the cargo mission. The mission is basically the same as the passenger mission, but we can do it with a pilot, and we can do it with conventional controls. And so that's where we're going to start first.
Mm-hmm. Well, my personal opinion is it's a lot easier to fly an airplane than it is to drive a car. Now, most people don't understand that, but the point is, in an airplane, you don't have nearly as many people wanting to zoom by you at 10 feet.
Right. And I think that in the end is one of the big advantages and the things that we can do. And so to enhance safety, we can monitor everywhere where the plane is going to land or take off from, and so we can really get to a very, very safe system with robotic controls. But again, that's down the line. And then to begin with, we'll start with a piloted airplane just delivering cargo.
You got a quick question, Marshall, let me step in, from Jack in Denver, and he wants to know if the planes are VFR or instrument rated.
So at this point, I think we'll start with VFR. I think that we'll quickly go to instrument rated. All that technology exists. It's existing package technology, so I think that we'll have instrument rated as soon as that's ready to be put in, basically.
Yeah, you can get a computer to give you instruments that are very good, that work off of GPS.
Right.
And, yeah, you're talking a couple of $1,000s. In fact, the transponder costs more than the artificial horizon system on, like, an iPad.
Right. So, you know, the first two planes we're going to build are going to be demonstrator planes, but as soon as we get, and then those probably will be just VFR just to start off with. But, again, as soon as we get into the part where we're trying to get certificated with the FAA for commercial certification, then, you know, of course we'll have instrument rating at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that's available now, actually, is some of the autopilots now are a little more sophisticated. They're called optionally piloted aircraft, OPA, and that's actually a computer that acts as a co-pilot. It's actually a little more sophisticated than just an autopilot. And so those are some of the technologies that we'll incorporate, and then as rules and regulations exist to certificate them, we'll incorporate that. So the big hurdle is getting your first plane to get a certificate for commercial operation. That's a five-year process at least, and it's hundreds of millions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
That's by far the biggest expense.
And it's the biggest hurdle because you got to convince the FAA that you're doing it right.
Correct. Well, no. I mean, and the idea is that once you have something that's right, then you can start adding to it, and you have a platform to work off of. And there's a lot of evolution to go, and we want to start with, we're trying to build that first platform that has the special capabilities of a plane that's fast, that can carry a decent payload, and that can land very short.
Mm-hmm. I wish you the best. I kind of talked a little too long, more than usual, so I'll let somebody else call in and ask some fun questions.
No, thank you, Marshall.
Thank you
for your questions.
Listener Marshall is off the line. It is 1-866-687-7223, and email drspace, drspace, at thespaceshow.com. Beverly is also Denver. Two of them from Denver tonight. Beverly says, if you're going to fly over San Francisco or Monterey or Fremont and the towns that you mentioned, while I don't live there, I am familiar with the Bay Area. I'm curious, does the FAA grant authority for all of this? Do you need to go to the state of California for anything? Do you need to go to counties? Do you need to go to the mayors of cities to get permission? Who has the ability to stop you, even if the FAA gives you a go?
Well, thank you for the question. My feeling, or our feeling with that, is that we have to get community acceptance. I do not think that we're going to be able to have to build a skyport, you need the local community acceptance to have a permit to build that, for example.
So, right, that's a building permit and all of that.
That's a building
design
permit. Without that building permit, we can't land. So that's very critical. And so, yes, we have to have community acceptance. I think that's our biggest challenge. That's what this project is more about than anything, is having community acceptance to be able to do it.
Can you just see the neighborhood coming out to hear your presentation for that? I mean, what they're going to say and do? Wow, I'd like to attend that meeting.
we're hoping that when people get used to seeing these airplanes delivering their packages and we can do same hour delivery, and we can do same day delivery for half the cost of overnight. So when people start seeing that their packages are coming on these airplanes, I think at that point some people are going to want to say, hey, I'd like to be on that thing. And we're hoping that that's where it leads to.
So
people would want to be on the plane.
Where do you
watch it come in?
Where do you stand? I'll get serious instead of having a good time talking to you and learning about it. What is your process now and your timeline? And you obviously, if it's going to cost many, many millions or hundreds of millions, you've got financing issues, then you've got manufacturing, testing, demo, timeline issues. Are we talking about a five-year timeline, a 25-year timeline? Give us some ideas of what you're realistically talking about.
Sure. So the timeline we're looking at right now is that we're right now looking to raise $25 million to build two demonstrator aircraft. And these are full-size. These are not prototypes. These are the real thing. And it's going to take about 2 years to build those.
Once you have the money.
Once we have the money. And so at that point, then we're saying it's going to take 5 years and the big money to get the commercial certification.
So
I think that once we have the demonstrators and we see what, amazing performance they're able to do, that the second round of money will actually be a lot easier to raise than this first round.
Okay, so are you in the process of raising the first round of money now?
We are.
And the first round is 25 million.
That's correct.
Okay, and I don't want real details here because this is radio, but are you venture capital or what are you doing for that? Printing money? What are you doing?
Yeah, we're going to print money. I think that's the best. We have to do that.
That's okay. The Treasury doesn't listen to the space show. You're cool. Don't worry about it.
Okay. No, so the two venture capital, this is a tough project for venture capital because we're looking so far down the line before we start having real returns. You know, the idea is now you invest $25 million and this gives you the opportunity to invest the second round of hundreds of millions. So really what we're looking for is a strategic partner, a company, and we're in some talks with people about that. The other possibility is that this is actually a relatively inexpensive way to get into aviation like this, so something really radically new that really will transform things. I mean, really is a trillion-dollar industry. And to do that, that an individual or a few individuals could get together and fund this. So that's the other, our other option, is somebody who wants to make a big difference here can very quickly change things by investing in this. And you know, we have a team. We have the engineering team. The engineering team is actually one of the winners of the Green Flight Challenge. These guys built an airplane in 9 months. This airplane got a fuel mileage equivalent of 400 miles per gallon per passenger. I mean, the airplane itself was 200 miles per gallon. To give you an idea, the year before, XPRIZE gave out a $10 million prize for the most efficient car. It got 100 miles per gallon. So here we have an airplane that was going twice as fast and was getting double the fuel mileage. So to give you an idea, it's just absolutely incredible. And so I worked with these guys, and I, you know, ever since then, I've wanted to work on with them again on a project. And that's a big part of this whole thing, is that we have an incredible engineering team to do this project.
So you've got a time period to raise the initial seed capital, then you've got 2 years to demo.
Right.
Then you got to raise more capital, and then you've got 5 years through the regulatory process. So
exactly.
You're looking at somewhere around 7 to 10 years?
Yeah, I mean, in 7 years, I am sure that, you know, the things with the FAA now are going a little more streamlined for this kind of project. There's a couple of electric airplanes that are going through the process right now, so that's actually going to be very beneficial for us, because there has not been an electric airplane certificated yet. So once these guys go through, that will really help us a lot. The other thing is that once we have these planes, you know, we can start commercial operations right away. I mean, we can start working with the parcel delivery. We can start working out of existing airports. We do not need to build special infrastructure for them to start off with. Now, we do want to get a skyport in near San Francisco, China Basin, that area, as soon as possible, because a large part of the market is in there, and the nearest airport is really down in Palo Alto and down by San Mateo there. So,
are you talking about San Carlos, the business
exactly,
airport?
San Carlos Airport.
Okay.
So that's really the nearest usable airport right now. So the whole part of the peninsula there would be much better covered if we could get much closer to San Francisco.
So could you use, this is like really crazy, but you mentioned China Basin. Could you use the giant stadium if they're not playing a game? I mean, clearly that's got enough field to do it in.
Yeah, it's a bit of a steep descent into it, though. No, we need a space on top of an existing warehouse. I mean,
you need to be higher up.
It's to our huge advantage to be higher up. It's just a lot easier in so many ways. So a rooftop on top of one of the large warehouses down there is all we need. And that's really, we think, very doable.
What do you have for competition?
So it's interesting. There are a lot of players in this urban air mobility market. they last December, I think I counted 100, and earlier this year it was 150, and then somebody last week in at Arrow told me it's up to 200. But all of these are VTOL type airplanes, vertical takeoff and landing, and we're different there. We're a fixed wing airplane. We're a conventional airplane, and their mission is a little bit different than ours. You know, we can't land in the driveway, and that's not what we're trying to do. So we're making a bigger plane and a faster plane and a little bit of a different plane. So it's we're not quite the same mission as they are.
Alice is in Seattle with an email question, and she said the battery pack power, is it similar to what's in an electric car like a Tesla?
Yes, so the battery packs are very similar to what's in an electric car, and we can work with existing battery technology. You know, battery technology keeps improving. Mostly, it's improving a little bit in performance, and it's improving a lot in price as the years go by. But the battery packs that were good 5 years ago are good for us. And obviously, we'll always be looking for the best battery pack, but the car battery packs are more than adequate.
And then you have to recharge them when it comes back down, right?
Correct. So the way we do it, again, we're looking at, you know, fast turnaround. So we use actually a robot to swap out the batteries, and you'll see that in the video. If you watch the video, it's in there. And so as the plane, and the plane actually doesn't stop. As the plane is moving, first one battery pack is swapped out, and then the next is swapped out as the plane is taxiing in the terminal. So in our system, we have a flight deck on top, kind of like an aircraft carrier. And then down below, we have the B deck, which is where the terminal is. And the planes actually go up and down from the flight deck to the terminal and back up by a ramp. And we actually use a ramp rather than an elevator because it's a little bit faster to drive down than it is to come to a full stop and have the elevator drop you down and then come out. So the idea is to try to keep moving as much as possible and only have to stop when actually the passengers are coming in and out.
So the elevator is only for the people. You're not putting the plane in an elevator.
No, we're not putting the plane in an elevator. Like I said, we use a ramp to go from one deck to the other.
Todd in San Diego says, have you priced or thought about what kind of liability insurance this would require and the cost for that insurance? Is it a deal breaker?
It isn't. The insurance is for something like this is significant. It's not. But again, as long as the planes, if we can move the planes quickly and if we can get a lot of use out of the plane, then that's not a problem. Basically, we can work with that.
How many flights a day out of one plane would you want to get? Like San Francisco to Monterey or Sacramento to Monterey?
Okay, so most flights are the average flight. So we actually did a study to figure out what the average distance, the weighed average distance. In other words, San Francisco to San Jose is like would be a very popular destination since there's a lot of businesses in San Francisco and a lot of business in San Jose. So we took that into account and we did a study. We took the top 300 zip codes and the average distance happens to be 69 kilometers, which I believe is 42 miles is the average distance. So it's just under 10 minutes. And so basically we can get there's a 3-minute turnaround time. So you're looking at about 6-7 flights an hour from an airplane.
Henry is chiming in, and he's in Los Angeles, and he says, years ago I lived in the Bay Area. And you used to be able to take a helicopter from various places, Sausalito, for example, and other places to the Bay Area airports to get to your connecting flight. and that business ended, and nobody has picked it up since then. And I remember flying from Sausalito to SFO was about 15 minutes one way.
Right.
So why do you think going from San Francisco to San Jose in your vehicle would be an advantage over what was being done in a helicopter, albeit noisy, bumpy, choppy, and rough, but not too expensive? And that didn't seem to hold up back in the 70s and 80s.
Well, I think that the big difference now is that we can do it for a lot cheaper. We can do it for, like I said, $39. You couldn't do that helicopter ride even 20 years ago for $39.
No, it was about $100
right.
if I bought a TWA ticket to support
right.
it. Yeah.
So there's that, and there's the noise issue. That's one of the biggest, and there's a safety issue. I mean, there was that accident, I believe it was in 77 in New York. Where
on the Pan Am building, right?
On the Pan Am building.
Yeah.
There was a horrible accident, and it was, you know, horrific visuals, and so that ended a lot of these programs. The other thing is that it's very expensive to operate a helicopter fleet, and the cost of operating helicopters is really prohibitive, especially if you're trying to do it on a large scale.
Well, I will say, no matter where I am, any place, I mean, I can be in Texas or wherever, you can hear a helicopter overhead. I mean,
yes.
They are very, very loud.
They are.
You know, and even worse inside the helicopter.
Right.
So.
And so the noise is an issue, especially, you know, over, you know, densely populated areas, the noise is always going to be an issue. And the costs of operating helicopters are significant, and even if they are, you know, the difference here now is that we're doing something that's electric, so that's the maintenance costs are much less. But the complexity of a helicopter does add a lot of maintenance to it.
Do you have a manufacturing facility now, or are you just an office in California? If people wanted to see what you were doing, does that yet exist for your company?
We have a hangar. That's about it. We do not. There's no manufacturing facility at this point, there really is. It's just an office, basically. Although we do have a hangar at locally here.
When you go in and do your pitch to potential financiers. Is this a hard sale? Do you have a lot of introduction to do to get them to even know what you're talking about?
Well, I'll tell you the truth. The difficulty is not once I can sit down with someone. There's really not a problem there. The problem is getting introductions to see people. That is our main difficulty, is just getting introductions. I don't know how else to say it. That's where the bottleneck. That's where the biggest problem we have is just to get in front of people. Once we're in front of people, I haven't been turned down yet.
Sally is in St. Louis, and she says two people is an awfully small vehicle. If this is successful and you wanted to expand, how hard is it, and how capable is your technology to take it up to a 4, 6, 8, 10-person vehicle?
Okay. So, yes, it is right now. It's a two-person vehicle. It does have an 800-pound capacity, so that does make it possible to go to maybe an average family of four would probably be able to handle that. Going beyond that, we don't see it. We don't see, even for a business use, you have to remember the trip is 5 to 10 minutes a lot of the time, or most, you know, not 10 minutes is the average time, right? And so a lot of trips are like just 5 minutes. And the idea of having to wait for two other people to show up to get on this plane that's not going to work. It's like waiting too long for an elevator. When you get there, you just want to get on and go. So we do a lot of work behind the scenes to get two people together, to get two people on board the plane. But to get more than that, I think, would be very, very difficult. and not, we don't see it as feasible.
So it's not like a scheduled commuter airline.
It's not. No, it's on. It's an on-demand type system. It's you when you show up and you go. I mean, if you're, you know, the trips are short. You're really not going to spend 20 minutes getting a ticket to go on a trip that's only 5-10 minutes. So no, it's something you just show up and you go. There's a lot of the sophistication of the passenger system is going to be in basically matching people up, knowing that they're coming, that two people are about to go to the same place, and getting them together onto one plane and go.
Could you could someone a tourist coming here book it for a tour over San Francisco, or would you have to fly corridors to go from point A to point B, and you couldn't just fly around and around the Golden Gate Bridge and over Fisherman's Wharf and stuff like that?
No, we do see a market for that. We do see that people coming to San Francisco, if we have this system here, that they're going to want to go for a ride, and we would set up, we actually calculated that in as to the percentage of passengers that would be tourists and the idea of exactly of giving them a scenic tour. I mean, I don't know if you've seen the picture. I don't know if all your viewers have seen it, but it's got a very nice cockpit, a very open cockpit, a great view. It's very quiet inside. It's like being inside a glider. You don't need a sound-canceling headset. It's a really terrific experience. There's nothing like, you know, seeing the view from 2,000 feet over a city. It's really spectacular. So, yes, we do totally envision seeing tourists would flock to this, or certainly there'd be a good number of tourists that would want to go for a ride on one of these. And so we would have, yeah, special routes for them. And the thing is that we have a lot of excess capacity in the deadhead direction. You have to imagine when people are in, let's say in the morning, most traffic to a location is coming one way.
Right.
Very few are leaving. So we have all... We count on having like 25% of the airplanes are actually empty. So that's a perfect opportunity to use that excess capacity for tourists or for other for other people who are interested.
Do you have a plan to take it to other cities and other states? Or I mean, are you looking like for a national rollout?
No, so we would start off, we're going to start off with the parcel delivery. We're going to start off in the Bay Area. It's kind of an ideal setup with the geography and the congestion of this area. And then, yeah, we do want to move the parcel service into other markets, starting in California, going into Texas, for example. So there's other areas that lend themselves to the parcel delivery system right away. So we'll start with one squadron of 25 aircraft and then build from that.
And so the one squadron of 25 aircraft is Bay Area only?
Correct. That's for the parcel transport, yes. And actually the first market we're going to go after or to focus on is healthcare, is most healthcare facilities get most of their supplies from overnight delivery, and so we think this is a perfect opportunity for us, and we can offer same day delivery instead of just overnight.
So the healthcare product has to get to where you are, and then you take it to its final destination.
Right. So the healthcare market is a little bit like the commercial market in the sense that they have warehouses. So that, you know, most of the big hospitals and all that do not have space at the hospital itself. They're very limited in space. They're, you know, in congested urban areas. So space is at a real premium, and storage space is almost non-existent. And so they have warehouses out in the valley, out in the Central Valley. There's a lot of the distributors have their warehouses out there, and then packages are shipped in from these warehouses. And so we can do basically warehouse to warehouse is what we call it. This is a term coined by my friend Mark Osman. But basically you have the large fulfillment centers in the valley, and those are about I would say 70 miles out from San Francisco, in the area of like Sacramento, Stockton, Tracy, and then you can come into a smaller warehouse where the packages are transferred to a delivery van, and the delivery van does the last mile. And with one skyport in the San Francisco area, like in the China Basin area, it would put 80% of healthcare facility would be within about 10 miles of a final distribution center. So within 20 minutes of the last mile would be within 20 minutes of that. And the flight from the warehouses to existing airports around the Bay Area and to the one facility in San Francisco, that's a 12-minute flight. So we can really, really speed things up, and we can pretty much guarantee it. We don't have to worry about, there's been a fender bender and it's, you know, caused gridlock on 580 all the way into Oakland, and, you know, everything is clogged up. You know, we don't have that issue. We can reliably count on the time that it takes us.
Listeners, there's still time if you would like to get a call in. Let me give out our number again. 1-866-687-7223. And of course you can continue using email drspace@thespaceshow.com. Roger's in Dallas, Texas. And Roger says, you mentioned earlier in the show that these were all-weather vehicles, but I can't imagine you're doing this with fog or these rainstorms that come into the Bay Area. The headwinds alone might prevent you from doing it. So can you be a little bit more specific, please, with all-weather?
Sure. So like any aircraft, you are limited, even the big jets are limited when the weather gets really, really bad, more so than a ground vehicle. And so we'll face the same limits. But one of the reasons, for example, that we have a plane that is fast or that can fly at 220 knots is that it gives it much more weather capability, for example. So again, when there's a storm, there's usually a storm cell, and during that time that the storm cell is coming through, no one can land, whether it's the big jets or any other airplane. But as soon as that passes through, then we're good to come in. And again, rain, strong winds, that doesn't stop big planes, basically. It'll stop the light sport, but it's not going to stop a plane of this size.
You'll have enough power to combat a headwind?
We do. The distances are really short. Like I said, the average distance is 10 minutes. So we're really not limited, with power. The other thing is that, with the electric motors, you can overpower them for short periods of time without causing damage. It's, you have a lot of capabilities that you don't have with a normal motor.
Really very interesting. So who typically is the candidate to fly these in your office? Are you looking for military drone pilot experience, or what's the profile to hire someone to do this?
We have the test pilots that were there at the Green Flight Challenge, and I've already run into them, and they're all eager to climb over each other to be the first one to fly it. So we're good on that front right now. We're really looking forward to getting these planes out there and flying them and showing them off. Everyone's very excited about it.
You mentioned that you were at an air show in Germany, right?
Correct. I was at the Aero Friedrichshafen. It's the big European general aviation air show.
So did you present your idea there? Any feedback? What did what kind of feedback did you get?
Yeah, we presented there. We got some. We actually got some great feedback and endorsements from companies there. Yeah, it was actually a very successful show. There is, I think there's a lot of latent enthusiasm for a fixed-wing aircraft to come into this market, and we certainly got that feeling while we were in Germany.
What is the wingspan? I don't think you mentioned that, but what is your wingspan?
It's just under 15 meters, so
45 feet.
45 feet or so, yeah.
This is an interesting question, although I bet I could answer it. Bob is in Reno, Nevada, and he said in places that have high elevation, like Albuquerque, Denver,
yeah.
Can it still work? Does the high altitude affect it? And is there any chance this could be adapted to land on water?
Okay, so the altitude is less of a problem with an electric motor because it's not really affected like an aspirating engine is. As far as the... temperature and altitude still affect the aerodynamics, so there's some limitations. There's more limitations because of that. So that's something definitely to be aware of and to consider. The payload is going to at takeoff is certainly going to go down a little bit because of that. As far as landing on water, we have not looked at that. We did actually in very early studies. We just found that. Weather limitations were much more severe, and I mean, on the other hand, they do it all the time up in Seattle and in Vancouver. We see water landing bush planes come in and out all the time from there. In this latest version here that we're looking at now, we are not looking at a water landing aircraft.
So you wouldn't be putting floats or something on that to make that a possibility?
Not at this point. We're not looking at that now. But I can see where, I can see where that could be a potential application. Again, it becomes very different because the way we use the landing gear doesn't really lend itself to, the water landing wouldn't be able to be as short takeoff and landing as what we can do now with the landing gear. The plane is comes in relatively fast. It comes in at around 50 knots, and for Stoll air, for the Stoll bush planes, that's actually very fast. The bush planes that we normally see, which are Stoll or even Super Stoll, but they come in at much, much slower speeds, and we are not able to do that.
It's actually pretty intriguing. So I just, on a personal comment, what do you deal with? Is there any training for the people that are going to go on this to get into something that is totally autonomous and it's not on the ground? I mean, you may have people that are apprehensive, scared, reluctant to do it.
Right.
How do you cross that? Kind of, I don't know. Don't want to use the word fear, but I will use the word fear. That kind of fear stage to get in an autonomous flying vehicle. I don't even want to get in a self-driving car.
Right. No, I've done informal surveys, and we've done some real surveys. It's definitely an issue. One of the reasons we've picked San Francisco and this is the Bay Area is because. A surprising number of people here go, yeah, I'd rather get into a robotic aircraft than get into one that I don't know who that pilot is. This area here really embraces this technology. I think that the self-driving cars, the autonomous cars, are really helping us a lot. When I came up with when I realized that the planes would have to be autonomous, that that there would not be able to be a pilot on board, it took me months to accept that idea. I just couldn't get comfortable with that. And it has to be. And I think now that, you know, when you talk about this and you talk about it within the circles of people who are in this business, who are working on this, it's self-evident that it'll be autonomous. Nobody even questions it anymore. So there's a learning curve. There's a getting used to idea curve of how to accept that. But it is happening. And I mean, we can have to give a lot of credit to the autonomous car industry for that, I think.
Yeah, I think you will. So if we want to follow and pay attention, so first of all, do you have a newsletter, or do you put out updates or anything like that through your website?
We haven't done that specifically. Once we get funded, that will be a full-time job. So that'll happen. Yes, the best thing is to follow us through the website. At this point, we do answer email, so there is a way to get a hold of us. There is an email address, and it works. And we will get back to you.
So the first milestone we would be looking at would be an announcement that says you've completed your $25 billion first round of financing.
Right. That's your
hoping to do that, obviously, in 2019, correct?
That's correct.
Or sooner.
That's even better.
Really an interesting project. And
thanks, Dave.
I don't know. I kind of, on the one hand, want to say that it's a gigantic uphill battle for you, but then you've got such great answers to questions that, you know, make me skeptical. Maybe it's not such a big uphill battle.
Well, the first part, the parcel transport version of this airplane,
uh-huh,
is really nothing special. It's really a pretty straightforward machine. And it really then sets us up for being able to present it, to be able to talk about it, to show it, and everything flows from that. Writing rules and regulations, you're writing rules and regulations to a very specific machine, at least, or, you know, one example is, here we have it. We have a real example.
You have a phone call?
Sure.
Maybe take us to the end of the program. Let's see who's on. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you, please? Where are you?
Tim from Huntsville.
Hi, Tim. Haven't heard from you in a while. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay.
Go for it.
Yeah, just one question. Have you ever thought about marketing this to search and rescue, to emergency services? It might be useful to have something that can fly around.
Yeah, thanks, Tim. We have thought about it some. That it's not the most ideal craft for that, because we really need a prepared surface to land on. We can land at a conventional airport, but to land short in an unprepared area is really would be really challenging for us at this point.
So it's not a grass field plane.
Exactly. It's not. It wouldn't do very well in a grass field. And so that's really the problem with that. It's also a very, very expensive airplane. And not to be able to use it, you know, a lot quickly and all the time, it doesn't lend itself to. I mean, a helicopter, I think, does a much better job in that scenario. Or I think we'd be hard pressed to compete against a helicopter in that scenario.
I don't see how you could. I don't see how you could have a flying car and not have a vertical takeoff and landing, just because of how much more difficult it is just to maneuver around. I'm assuming that this thing is going to drive around some, and whenever the vehicle operator feels the need to, they can take off.
Yeah, well, we have, you'll see in the video, we have a very specific designs of skyports with the the airstrip for landing and the battery swapping facilities and the passenger terminal. There's a very infrastructure intensive kind of setup, and it's meant, you know, for very densely urbanly urban populated areas, whatever, for where there's a lot of people, basically. That's because that's where the market is. And so, you know, we're looking at being able to move 1,000 passengers an hour. And so to do that, you really need an infrastructure that's dedicated to that.
So you're talking about more like a sky taxi?
Correct. This is more like a sky taxi, yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, this is not... This is not a personal air vehicle. You would never want to own one of these. You wouldn't get landing rights at any of the skyports. It's not a personal air vehicle. It's really like you say, a sky taxi type of system.
Okay. Well, that's all. Well, thank you very much.
Yep.
Thank you, Tim. I appreciate your call. Listeners, if you want to get a call in or an email, you need to hurry up and do it because we're pretty much at the end of the program. One more time, 1-866-687-7223. So do let the fingers start dialing, unless you have an autonomous telephone. And email drspace@thespaceshow.com. What have we not talked about that you wanted to make sure we talked about tonight? What have we forgotten, omitted, or just been too ignorant to even ask you about?
No, I think we covered a lot of things.
Do your friends think you're a nut?
Yeah, but that was before I started this. This has been a great journey. We're having a lot of fun with this at this point. It was great to be in Germany to see the team, the engineering team, in person, and go out and have some beers together. And this is we're doing this because it's a fun project. We don't really have to do this. We really want to do this. It's something that we're all very excited about, and it makes it a real special project for us. I think the plane is going to be a lot of fun to go for a ride in. I think we forget to talk about how fun the experience is of actually being able to ride in one of these.
Well, being able to look out, because again, you have such an incredible view according to the picture,
right?
It would be lots of fun once you get comfortable that it's not going to go fall into the street,
right? That's absolutely true, and we have to do the safety aspect is really important. We actually have to be much safer than commercial aviation because of the numbers. The number of takeoffs and landings that we do is much higher than a normal commercial airport. And so that issue really comes up, the whole safety thing. And this is not going to survive if we start having accidents. You know, if once a month there's some incident, that's not going to sell very well. So the whole safety for this whole industry, the safety aspect of it is really critical, and so that's part of why, you know, you're looking at robotic aircraft to do something like this. You really need incredible reliability.
Here's a little bit of an offbeat question that just came in. This is probably the last one of the evening.
Okay.
Benny is in Oklahoma City.
Okay.
And he said, you're talking about computers running everything. And he says, I'd really like to know what kind of computer you have that is so safe enough and so reliable enough to do this, and what operating system. Surely this is not going to be from Apple or Microsoft because their stuff isn't reliable. What could you possibly be using that would allow you the comfort for the safety that you require?
Okay, so we actually would be using the software validation systems that NASA uses. They have incredibly rigorous rules and systems for their software. And so it, you're right. We would not be using commercial
software. So you're not
software.
Using Windows or a Mac or something like that?
We would not at all. The other thing is we use, there's a lot of redundancy built into the systems, and there's also what we call alternate systems. So, for example, if you have a sensor that's subject to freezing, then we have other sensors that are not. They work differently, a totally different method, and accomplish maybe not the same, quite the same thing, maybe not quite as accurately as our preferred sensors, but enough that you can extrapolate the data from them and get an adequate reading. But so things like that, where you're not relying on one type of technology to do a mission critical be able to perform a mission critical function, but you have alternate methods to do that. For example, we're not relying just on GPS. We're not relying just on LIDAR, or we're not relying on just machine vision. So these different systems give us another layer of protection, basically. Then we also have the idea that the data that comes in is analyzed and action is taken immediately. We don't just wait till the plane comes down and for the plane to be told, or for the maintenance people to be told, well, there's a problem with this or that. We look at the whole system the whole time, and if something is starting to not operate right, we pull the plane right then and there. We also have what we call the measure of the last resort. So there's a parachute on board.
Okay, that's going to be fun, getting them into a parachute, right?
So the idea is that, yeah, safety is really, really a critical aspect of this just because of just the numbers.
Wouldn't it be better to use one of those systems where the whole plane becomes a parachute?
Oh, that's what I'm saying, yes.
Instead of putting people in a parachute?
No, the people aren't in a parachute, the plane.
So you've got one of those systems where the cockpit, so to speak, is in a parachute.
Correct, yes.
You have another caller.
Okay.
Hi, caller. Who are you, and thank you for calling?
Oh, this is Marshall again.
We must have woken you up there. So what's
No. You just walked right through one of my favorite topics.
What is that one?
I spent a good portion of my professional career being a computer geek that did the numerical control equipment and special test equipment, and the bottom line on almost everything was the safety of the system was directly related to the quality of the software.
Right.
It is so critical to get people who really have a feel for the art of programming computers to make sure the system is solid. You can have the cheapest, dumbest, sloppiest little computer in there, and if it's programmed well, it can do a fantastic job, and it takes very little electricity, and it weighs next to nothing.
Right.
But the software has to be there.
I agree.
Well,
and where do you go to find that software programming genius?
I don't know. What town do you live in again, in Oklahoma?
Well, I'm spoken for. Sorry about that.
All I can say is my experience with Windows 10, for example, I'll just use that as an experience, is such a nightmare. I can't imagine anybody using that for anything that was critical, including their business functions. It's just a garbage. But when I go to UCSF and the medical centers and stuff, you know, they're running medical programs and they're using Windows software, and sometimes they're using Mac, and you know, I'm wondering, you know, how that, of course they have whole staffs that just keep the stuff running. They probably pay 50,000 times more for the IT help to keep their stuff running than they do for the equipment and the software.
And then every time that there's a problem and it gets reported back to the, you know, the real software engineer,
That person has to know that system well enough to turn around and fix the problem in a timely manner. And that's what has screwed Boeing, isn't it?
Yes, and I'm sure it's a problem at the medical centers, too.
Yep.
Because they've got some pretty sophisticated medical stuff, and if your Windows 10 machine did updates and it no longer works, which happens to me 50% of the time, then you got to go, you know, figure out how to back that crap out and fix it. So I just hope that whatever you're using is a far different category of reliability than we consumers and business people go out to the local store or Amazon or Best Buy and buy.
Oh, yeah. I hope so, too.
It's garbage. So,
and it's also why you're starting with real pilots, right?
Yes, we are.
Anyway, I just had to toss that in.
No, that's fine. That's great. No, we all agree with you.
I'm going to call you the next time my Windows 10 machine craps out, Marshall.
Oh, no. I don't. I do Linux. I do Unix. I do lots of odd things, but I don't screw with Windows 10.
I've got your number, Marshall.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for your call. Anything else we should have talked about or that you want to say?
No, I think I'm good here. Just
Well, listen, we wish you luck. I'd like to stay in touch with you and follow.
No,
and if you ever want to meet for coffee or something, if you ever down in the Roanoke Park area, I go up there for food and things pretty frequently. So maybe we can meet sometime.
Let me know next time you're coming up. That's kind of in between.
Delighted. Yeah. Okay. I'll look forward to that. And we will stay in touch. And I wish you the best of luck with the project. And I'll archive this early in the morning and get it off to you. And I'll look forward. I won't hear them flying around.
Okay.
You know, it'll be like a Prius, you know. And in the DMV book, it's got all these rules in there about what to do to avoid being hit by an electric car that you can't hear.
Really?
Oh, I mean, they got pages of that stuff. So I guess that's a problem for people that they can't hear the car coming.
Right.
And the next thing they know is they're hit. So, you know, in parking lots and stuff. So they've adopted that into pages of the California handbook. So.
That's fine.
Bruno, it's great meeting you. I look forward to hearing more. And I hope you get it together. And I'll look up and I'll say, hey, I did a show with that guy when it was just in a theoretical stage.
Yeah.
Good luck. And we'll talk to you again down the road, I'm sure.
I'm sure. All right. Thank you very much, David. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. And listeners, back again Friday morning with another Space Show program. Thank you all. Have a continued great week. And welcome to May, which is just a couple of hours away. Good night from Bruno, David, and the Space Show.